Support for WVIK comes from Kathleen Collins at the Dragonfly in Bettendorf. Using both conventional and alternative counseling methods for empowerment to help create change for individuals and couples. More information is at KathleenCollinsCounseling.com.
Catching up today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Rebecca Wee.
And I'm Don Wooten. We're behind on reviews, so we'll dig into some today on Scribble. Back in the olden days, when we first started this program, I went back and looked at the record, and I listed the guest and then the books that were reviewed on the same program. And that went on for about, 3 months. And then after that, I just quit listing the books that were reviewed because quite often we would get into an interview. Normally, we do 20 minutes of interview and then reviews.
Right.
And the reviews just got blown away.
Uh-huh.
So we are guilty. We are guilty.
So we don't know necessarily what's going to come up in conversation. So
that's true. But let me mention again, and we'll try to do this on a regular basis. We have a website that you can contact to tell us about books that you've enjoyed or complain about something really stupid we did. However you want to use it, but it's simply contact Scribble 1014. That's the date we first went on the air, October 14th. So contact Scribble 1014 at gmail.com. We'll mention that again at the end of the program. So if there are books you've read that you wonder why in the heck we haven't dealt with them, it's because they're hundreds of thousands of books out there, and we don't get to very many of them. So contact Scribble 1014 at gmail.com. So let's see. Let me revisit to begin something I talked about before, and that was Stephen Fry's great trilogy on mythos. And I do say great because I had a great time reading all three books. I've showed you the beautiful format of the last one, Troy, and it matches the first book, Mythos. But for some reason, the middle book, Heroes, came out looking like a regular fat novel. It really is something you ought to think about reading because Stephen Fry has accomplished, I think, something absolutely amazing. It's a daunting bit of scholarship, but it is such a pleasant read because all the way along, he humanizes the stories.
Yeah.
When Zeus tells Hera something in myth, he provides the dialogue. And he lists every blessed demigod and god and goddess you've ever heard of. He names the 20 hounds that tore up Actaeon. I mean, the guy really knows his stuff. And in Heroes, he picks out Perseus, Heracles, Bellerophon, Orpheus, Jason, Oedipus, and Theseus, and tells their story in great detail, along with the variants. And his footnotes are informative and sometimes just plain funny.
Yeah.
Because he will say, you know, that so-and-so, you will remember, was listed as so-and-so and was the godmother of another one. And on Bellerophon, the first footnote on that, he says, the poet says of Eurynome, I guess that's her name, he refers to this person, a marvelous scent rose from her silken raiment as she moved, and beauty was wafted from her eyes. No one has ever said anything as wonderful as that about me.
Those are his notes.
Oh, yeah. And at one point, after you go through the third volume, and he mentions so-and-so, the incestuous relationships and the time lapses and so on, and he reminds you of this and says, mm-hmm. you, period, will, period, remember.
So the three are Troy, in order.
The first one is Mythos.
Mythos is the first.
And then Heroes.
Okay.
And then Troy, which concentrates on Troy.
Okay.
And I cannot recommend those books too highly. They're hefty, and they're beautifully produced. Especially, I think the first and third are almost alike in their format. For some reason in Troy, the footnotes are in a slightly lighter ink, which I found not off-putting, but I thought, why did they do that?
Huh.
The second book, Heroes, is like a regular novel, but it has two marvelous series of color plates in here that are as beautifully produced as anything I've ever seen. So I cannot back off even an iota from my enthusiastic support of Stephen Fry's 3-volume set on mythology. It will make mythology as entertaining as anything you've ever read, and believe me, scholastically, he is solid.
So should they be read in that order, or doesn't it matter?
I don't think it matters, but it matters this way. If you read the first book, you get a grounding in how all these gods got started, their origin stories, and so on. And then in Heroes, his footnotes refer you back to the details in Mythos, and the same way in Troy. That's where he says you will remember.
Yeah.
Because you can go back to those earlier ones to get a fuller explanation of what's in front of you right now. Because let's face it, these stories can be confusing.
Yes, yes. Well, now do you have a favorite passage or a favorite story or from one of them that you've just read, or can't you choose?
No, I didn't think to isolate anything, but I want to mention, and I may do this in some detail in a future program, David Orr wrote a review of an earlier book by Stephen Fry, came out several years ago, called The Ode, O-D-E, Less Traveled. And he starts off by saying in his review of the book, the difficulty of teaching poetry to a lay audience can be summarized by a single diabolical name, Robin Williams. Williams, as you may recall, played the free-thinking English teacher John Keating in the 1989 movie Dead Poets Society, a film that established once and for all the connection between learning about poems and killing yourself while wearing a silly hat. In the movie's first depiction of poetical pedagogy, Williams, as Keating, instructs his students to open their textbook, a dry, dully diagrammatic primer by Dr. J. Evans Pritchard, and then, with the insouciant panache of Lord Byron, or possibly Patch Adams, tells them to rip out the introduction. Yes, rip. Armies of academics going forward measuring poetry, cries the righteous Keating. No, we will not have that here. Instead, the class is told to embrace the philosophy of carpe diem and sic transit J. Evans Pritchard. Significantly, however, while Keating subsequently teaches his students how to stand on their desks, how to kick a soccer ball with gusto, and how to free associate lamely about Walt Whitman, he's never shown actually teaching them anything about the basics of form, basics they need in order to appreciate half the writers he's recommending. And the review goes on from there, and it is priceless, just priceless.
Yeah.
But he talks, this is where it's useful to turn to another actor, Stephen Fry. And he talks about, his background in theater, which is odd indeed, but it's oddly effective. The Ode Less Traveled is at once idiosyncratic and thoroughly traditional. It's filled with quips, quirks, and various Fry-isms, Sestinas, for example, are a bitch to explain, but a joy to make, and yet still manages to be a smart, comprehensive guide to prosody, and on and on. I've got to read that book.
Yeah.
Because the trilogy is on myth is just fascinating, and I have a deeper and wilder appreciation of Stephen Fry than I ever had before.
All right. I'm on it. I'm on it for next time.
Have you had time to do any reading at all?
Yes. Summer is good for that. I was traveling with the family out to California for a grandfather's 89th birthday. And on the airplane, actually, all right, let's backtrack. A couple years back, a Vietnamese-American writer named Ocean Vuong, spelled V-U-O-N-G, was recognized for his first collection of poetry. And it made a big splash in the poetry world because, how do you summarize it? Because he's writing poignantly about trauma, about history, about his own journey as a child who came from Vietnam to this country when he was 2 years old, I think, and trying to learn the language, and his mother is illiterate. And anyway, the poetry that came out of that really, really got under people's skin in a way that is rare for poetry. And then just a couple years ago, he published, 2019, I think it came out, a book called On Earth, We're Briefly Gorgeous. And it's a novel, but it's also, it's kind of a hybrid. It's a novel because he invents, but he's also basing it in his life experience, being raised by a mother and a grandmother. He does some family history, but it's kind of like when writers do create, well, we always do, don't we? We think that you're writing in somebody else's voice. You're going to write a persona piece, but then you look at it years later and say, oh, that was really me. I thought I might not have written it if I thought I was writing as myself. So you write, you know, through some lens that distances you a little bit. But anyway, the book's gotten a lot of well-deserved attention, and I had wanted to read it and hadn't gotten around to it. So it was being sold in the airport, and that blew my mind. I thought, this is a poet, and this book has gotten so much attention. It's been a New York Times bestseller. So I wanted to know what all the fuss was about in prose, and what the fuss is about is the story, is his style, is his sensibility, his it's heartbreaking and it's funny and it's gorgeous. And
On Earth, We Are Briefly Gorgeous.
We Are Briefly Gorgeous.
I've never experienced that.
You have. He'll show you that you have and how you have. I'll read just a little passage. This isn't, there's some shocking passages. There's a coming of age that's really beautiful and heartbreaking. Lots of memories as a child of trying to make one's way. But he's at this point in the book, the speaker. The book's written really as a letter to a mother by a son who doesn't expect her to read it because she can't read in English. But he's making his way through, you know, his history as a Vietnamese child, as an American, as her son. So I'll just read a little tiny bit where you get a sense of what he does. He kind of time travels without, that's not even the right word for it. So he and a best friend are riding their bikes through neighborhoods and parts of town and sort of remembering what they were and looking at what they became. So we passed the tenement building on New Britain Avenue where we lived for 3 years, where I rode my pink bike with training wheels up and down the linoleum halls so the kids on the block wouldn't beat me up for loving a pink thing. I must have ridden down those halls 100 times a day, the little bell clinking as I hit the wall at each end. How Mr. Carlton, the man who lived in the last apartment, kept coming out and yelling at me each day, saying, "Who are you? What are you doing here? Why don't you do that outside? Who are you? You're not my daughter. You're not Destiny. Who are you?" But all that, the whole building is gone now, replaced by a YMCA. Even the tenement parking lot, where nobody parked since no one had cars, busted through with weeds nearly 4 feet high, is gone. All of it bulldozed and turned into a community garden with scarecrows made from mannequins thrown out by the dollar store off Bushnell. Entire families are swimming and playing handball where we used to sleep. People are doing butterfly strokes where Mr. Carlton eventually died alone in his bed. How, no one knew for 3 weeks, until the whole floor started to reek and the SWAT team had to come bust down the door with guns. How, for a whole month, Mr. Carlton's things were left out in a big iron dumpster out back, and a wooden hand-painted pony, its tongue-lulled face, peeked out of the dumpster's top in the rain.
Yeah, that's so very good. It's powerful stuff.
He'll cover these physical terrains, but then also the emotional and the memory, and it's just fascinating how the whole piece is kind of woven together, and just beautiful, beautiful writing.
So what on earth?
On earth, we're briefly gorgeous. Ocean Vuong, V-U-O-N-G is his last name.
Okay. Well, I ran across a book that I bought some time ago and never bothered to read, and I picked it up and thought, well, let's give it a shot. It's called God, A Human History by Reza Aslan. He is from the Middle East and was raised as a Muslim, became a Christian, went back to Islam, and concentrated on the Sufi religion. And he gives a history of God from a personal point of view, but it also covers a lot of ground. It's a fairly brief account, 171 pages, makes up 60% of the book. The rest consists of notes. You can repair some of those notes, run over 2 pages.
Sure.
So he's done a very thorough job, but people have greeted this book with great joy and with great alarm. But he points out that they've discovered at Göbekli Tepe, I guess it is, something that predated Stonehenge by many, many years, 14 to 12,000 years ago.
Wow.
It's obviously a ceremonial site, and this is before agriculture took in.
Oh,
now,
right.
The theory is that it was agriculture that shaped society. He maintains maybe it was religion. And he traces the idea, where did we get the idea that there was a God?
Yeah.
Because it's something we had to think about. And it seems, first of all across the world, there was some kind of animal god, or animals were thought to have a spirit behind
powers,
them.
Yeah.
But this is a million years or so that humans lived without being self-aware. And then as self-awareness dawned, as you look around, you think, what's going on?
Yeah.
And he traces this, the transition of this, into Sumer, where writing started, somewhere around 4500 BC, but they didn't get around to, we don't have anything that goes back more than about 2500 BCE.
Mm-hmm.
And the Gilgamesh epic is one of the most important ones.
Yeah.
But he talks about this quote, "The gods of Sumer were born to mothers who suckled them when they were young. They had fathers with whom they clashed as they grew older. They fell in love and got married. They had sex and birthed children. They lived in houses with their families and had relatives with whom they formed giant celestial clans. They ate and drank and complained about work. They argued and fought with one another." These were gods made in human likeness.
Yeah.
He says the Mesopotamians eventually worshipped a pantheon of more than 3,000 deities with idols for each. Similar developments occurred in Egypt, India, and Greece, where gods were always described in human terms. They fought over petty jealousies, had family problems, displayed good and bad moods, and could be all-knowing or just plain stupid. So we created gods that were human. And he said it wasn't until about 1200 BCE that the Jewish people arose, and they had two gods, Yahweh and El. And he maintains that Yahweh was a Midianite god who had a consort. If I can remember her name, Ashtaroth. I think she became Ashtaroth later on. And then the Canaanite god was El. And Israel means El preserves. Mm-hmm. And somehow they came together about a single God, and it was Yahweh, and he did not have a consort. He was just one God, monotheist. But the idea of monotheism arose in 1353 BCE with Akhenaten, who was the first monotheist, and somehow that idea caught hold. He takes you all the way through this, from animal gods, many human gods, and then he finally winds up in Sufism, where God is not a person. God is in everything. Everything is God. It makes me think energy. Of a Hindu who once told me that God is in you, and your job is to bring God out. Mm-hmm. And it's a kind of pantheism. And he settles in Sufism because he thinks that may be a more satisfying answer. It's a fascinating book, and it's a quick read, but one that you will find enlightening or disturbing, but I think you'd be better off for having read it.
Yeah. Oh, good.
It's called God, A Human History by Reza Aslan. Isn't it interesting? His last name is A-S-L-A-N.
To make you think of C.S. Lewis.
Yeah, the lion that is a figure for Christ in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
I was just thinking that. Oh, my.
The coincidences in life.
Isn't it?
Well, we're too little long here. We have a few minutes. You have another book that you want to mention?
Yeah. I haven't finished this one yet, but I'm loving it, and it's on a subject that wouldn't normally catch my attention, I don't think. It's by the writer Eula Biss. Her name is spelled E-U-L-A, and then the last name is B-I-S-S, Eula Biss. The book is called Having and Being Had, which is about our consumer culture, I guess. But because I first fell in love with her writing when I read her book, The Balloonists, which was a kind of memoir that she wrote in little fragments. You often didn't know who was speaking, and you had to. It was a very strange approach that grew on me as I read it, and I used it in class 1 year, and it freed, just the structure of it freed some of the students who were writing kind of pedestrian, predictable, I was born here and I grew up doing this. And
Mm-hmm.
This book, for all its initial sort of confusion when I gave it to the class, just took off for some of them. And they ended up writing beautifully because they were freed by her idea that you could do this in kind of fragments and not explain everything, but trust the reader to kind of pull it together. Anyway, the book she's writing about right now, the little flap on the front of the book says, this is Eula Biss writing, "My adult life can be divided into two distinct parts, the time before I owned a washing machine and the time after." And she's largely using the purchase of her first home to kind of, and the neighborhood that she's in, to delve into capitalism, into racism, into her experience of being a mother for the first time and being an academic. She teaches at Northwestern. But they're in little chapters of about 4 pages, titled things like Affluence and Comforter. Oh, I've got to read a little bit of Comforter because it the word there struck me as so interesting. You know, a comforter is a person or a pet or something that brings you comfort, but it's also, you know, a big poofy blanket, you know.
Okay.
I'll just read the first section. The comforter is too big for our washing machine, but we no longer live within walking distance of a laundromat. I wonder what people who live in houses do when they need to wash their comforters. They drive in cars, I'm sure. And she goes on to discuss kind of the phenomenon of the laundromat, of a washing machine, of trying to wash something that's too big for your washing machine. She finds the unexpected in kind of the ordinary things that we may or may not think about in a day, and then brings them to this idea of having things and then being had by those impulses.
Yeah, you become possessed by your possessions.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's, after a while, I think, if you have a little time to stop and think, that registers.
Yep.
That you are confined by the things you own.
Exactly.
And they shape the way you behave. I can't get over to this day when I do laundry. You dump stuff in a tub, you put it in, you press a button, and you leave.
Yeah.
I remember when we did it the hard way.
Oh, exactly. Hand washing with the little washer boards,
oh, yeah.
Right? And hanging them out on the line. And
yeah, life has changed in significant ways. So having
and being had.
And the author is Eula Biss.
Yep.
That makes me think of a singer who was popular way back when. Can't think of her name. Eula Bay, I believe.
Hmm.
Yeah, that's a name you don't run into anymore.
Yes.
But
well,
anyway, we talked about a trilogy, a book about God, about being gorgeous while you're on Earth.
Oh,
having and being had. But you know, the real question we would like to put to you is, what are you reading? What do you think people ought to read? We have this this email address you can go to and share your thoughts with us, because otherwise we live in a closet, so it's hard to find us. But it's simply contactscribble. You can spell that as well as I can, but contactscribble, 1014, 1014, and that's at gmail.com. And we love to hear your thoughts on the books you have read, the books you like, the things you think we ought to read, and correct us any way you want. But it gives you an opportunity to talk back, because we sit here and talk to each other and with our guests, but we don't get a chance to talk to you. So this is your opportunity. Contact Scribble, 1014 at gmail.com. And we hope you will do that. I think that just about clears the board for today, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Okay. Thank you, Rebecca. And thank you for listening. And we'll also thank our theme for popping up at an opportune moment. And we will head out of here. I'm Don Wooten with Rebecca Wee. We'll be back next week, and we hope you will too. And we hope to have your comments on Scribble.